So the French owed the owed the U.S. a ton of money from all the pirates' activity.
No, this is the bill.
Yeah, no, dude, that's what it was. See, this is, and again, we don't cover this in history class.
Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the Lockheed Electra Tenny to Eric's Amelia, if you decided to forego economics for the freedom of the skies. If you've been following along from the beginning, then you know that Eric's almost got that axe ground into dust completely by now. I can't imagine it gets any better now that we're looking at the other notable events and characters from Thomas Jefferson's past.
What an Amelia Earhart reference. It's unbelievable.
I figured you might appreciate a good plane reference.
Oh, I do, especially because, you know, I by law have to bring everything back to Quincy. Amelia Earhart actually spent a lot of time in the Squanum Aerodrome early in her career learning to fly and navigate.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Actually, my neighbor growing up, she was, like, one of the, like, women who would do, like, the navigate, like, set up navigation paths for planes. That's kind of cool.
Sounds like she maybe should have spent some more time there.
Oh, that's good.
Sorry,
we got to do a show back because it's a beautiful example of if you know physics just a little bit better. Veritasium did a whole
show. He's got a great channel, doesn't he?
It's the best channel on YouTube. Besides today, I found out they're number one.
You know, The Buck Starts Here is getting some pretty good stuff on there too. You know. All right, where do we leave off part two? I remember we're getting a little bit kind of down because there just didn't seem to be a whole lot of good stuff to learn about Jefferson.
Oh, because there's generally speaking not. He's a good example of, like, there's really interesting stuff about him up front, but then there's just that insidiousness. And I think this is through the entire Virginia dynasty of the first six presidents. You know, of that hypocrisy, the contradiction of being somebody so fervently pro-liberty, followed by being somebody who owned slaves and expanded their slave ownership. But where we left off was on the Embargo Act. I've been walking through that, and that was the second biggest economic and probably history-shaking thing that Jefferson did during his presidency. A lot of some of the Adams and a lot of stuff they did was far more impressive pre their presidency. Obviously, Jefferson's presidency was just full of landmark things, but it was Louisiana Purchase. We kind of sat on the footsteps of that because the Louisiana Purchase is arguably the most interesting diplomatic action ever taken by any, I would say, during any administration. It is fascinating how America got to get literally one of the largest land swaps in world history. I mean, when you think of the size of, I'm gonna list off every state that has a piece of property that was part of the Louisiana Purchase. Just let's go ahead.
All right.
Arkansas, Colorado, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, New Mexico, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Texas, Wyoming. When have you ever heard Louisiana and North Dakota mentioned the same geographic space?
Montana, was that in there too?
Yes, Montana was there too. Oh, yeah, Montana. See, literally, you go all the way almost to Washington State because Idaho was in there too.
Yeah.
How much economic activity is in those states? It would be the third largest economy in the world, just those 15 states, $5.8 trillion in economic activity.
Today,
yes.
Not when we bought it.
No, primarily just, we'll get into this with the Lewis and Clark,
yeah.
Because even though it was only 200 years ago, the flora out there looked completely different.
Fun random
economic fact here. So if you took the United States GDP and you removed these 15 states, America would still be the largest economy, followed by China. And if these states became their own nation, they would be the third.
Huh.
And I found that funny that you could actually remove 15 states. You can remove the third largest economy from the U.S. economy, and the U.S. economy is still the number one economy. Just remember that, everybody. So next time I talk trash about Wyoming, I will have to remember that. I'm joking. I love Wyoming. What a cool state.
Can you take 15 countries out of the EU and do the same thing?
No. So I think I posted this on maybe LinkedIn a while ago. If every U.S. state was its own country, those states would make up 26 of the top 50 largest nations, economic-wise. Yeah, we're just so far ahead of everybody else. Like, it's a complete, it's just, there's no comparison. There's absolutely no comparison. You know, this is one of my favorite parts of teaching microeconomics, is I get freshmen, and we're usually the first true, pure economic course. I tell a lot of my students at the beginning of the semesters that I'll say, like, hey, has anybody taken an econ course before? Maybe some of them have taken, like, AP econ, which isn't really the same as taking, like, collegiate economics. I say, well, up until this point, your opinions in economics are heavily influenced by your history classes and your political opinions, and neither one of those is relevant in studying macroeconomics. And, you know, it's fun because I think people just forget how absolutely massive the U.S. economy is. We just forget that our states are just so economically powerful. And then we all got together. We were all like, wait a minute. Let's huddle up. Huddle up, guys.
The size and scope of this purchase is massive. Like, what brought about the need to even, like, put this up for sale? Like, why was France, like, willing to even part with this territory?
All right, so France kind of wasn't. It wasn't sold. Like, it wasn't out on the market. Like, one of the things I got really interested on, like, you know, during the mechanical purchase of this was, like, what does this look like?
Yeah.
So what happened is Jefferson basically sent a team of diplomats over to France, over to meet with Napoleon, and there was a secret agreement the French had with the Spanish, and it was called the Treaty of San Ildefonso, mm-hmm. which I probably butchered pronouncing that, and it was signed on October 1st, shout out, that's my dad's birthday, 1800, not the year though. So it was a secret treaty, and when I mean secret, I mean, like, they didn't want it, like, the Brits to know, because the Brits were good, obviously they still had a lot of control. They had like an absolute ton of control in North America, because after the Seven Years War, the French and Indian War, basically France has to cede a lot of its territory in modern day Canada to the French. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were relative at this point, after the war, the Seven Years War, Spain was a huge ally of France. So in 1763, they were like, hey, Spain, we really can't control this anymore. We don't have our holdings to Canada anymore. They obviously, I mean, Spain, huge, huge right. ownership. I mean, it wasn't until the Treaty of Hidalgo that we really saw, like, modern-day Southwest America become Anglicized. And I don't even know if that area's ever been fully Anglicized. I just mean it, like, has
not
become
really.
No, right? You lived out there, Kyle. So it's not, right? Like, even the town names aren't really Anglicized.
Not really.
So what happened after, in, like, 1763, as, like, kind of a thank you, or I guess just from a mode of practicality, the French, also kind of in secret, this wasn't, like, part of, like, the treaties that ended the Seven Years' War, gave control, in quotation marks, very vague. Like, one of the problems with the Louisiana Purchase is that there's actually, like, no boundaries ever defined during any of this. And it's because the French and the Spanish never really wanted to find a boundary. If anybody's ever interested, the Anglo-Adams War, which I will probably throw in an Excel file to pitch to Laura and Kyle, that I would absolutely love to do, like, a 5-minute quick one on that. Like, the U.S. and the it was basically a border skirmish in, I believe it was 1850s, between Maine and Canada. Because we didn't know what the border between Maine and Canada was. We just never bothered to figure it out. So that same thing happened, but instead of north-south, this was an east-west. And so for about 37 years, the Spanish administered the Louisiana Territory on behalf of the French. Now, it may seem weird to say that. Like, how did nobody know this was going on? Because nobody lived there. It had a population of, like, 0.5 people per square mile.
There's all, like, traders and beaver trappers, right?
Yeah. There's about 300,000 indigenous people in there, then another 60-ish thousand traders and stuff like that. But, like, half of those were centralized on, you know, major outposts mm-hmm. down the Mississippi River. So, like, nobody's, like, walking around. This is, this is like, an impregnable forest land. I mean, nobody would have guessed that it would turn into the largest and most important agricultural area in the entire world. Like,
that literally feeds the world. Yeah.
Really feeds the world. The U.S.'s largest export is agricultural goods.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are the world's leading exporter. How big are we? The next closest person behind us is Brazil. And Brazil is $6 trillion behind us. what? That's just, they are every other, they are like the like economy of like India and a half behind behind us for the sector. Yeah, I saw some recent guy online made a post that was like, oh yeah, the U.S., like, we import all this food and all that stuff. I'm like, no, we don't. That survived no research. You made no effort. I love the bold claims that are clearly like, wow, you never picked up a book, buddy. Like, you never even right. tried. I'm going to introduce you to something called the Great Plains. So, yeah, it's very bizarre. But what ended up happening is October 1st, 1800, you had the Treaty of San... And I can't wait to get lit up because I cannot pronounce this word for the life of me. Ildefonso, that was signed between France and Spain, re-administering the territory back to France. So in 1801, treaty gets signed and it goes back to the French control. But it's kind of funny. So it goes back to French control, and the Spaniards are like, "Hey, we'll give it back to you, but if you ever sell it, you got to give it back to you have to sell it to us or give it back to us." And they were like, Napoleon's like, "Hey, sounds good." As part of the sale, there was this agreement that France, now you gotta imagine, Napoleon's expanding all that stuff. And as Napoleon's expanding, he's going to like northern Italy, like modern day, like Piedmont area, stuff like that. And then if you go back under Adams and Jefferson, Adams and Washington, I know we talked about a lot, Kai, but we talked about, you know, the importance of free navigation of trade, mm-hmm. And some treaties we have with the Spanish at that time. So I don't know how secret it was. I mean, if you're signing a trade deal to make sure ships can freely go up and down the Mississippi River, I'm assuming right. the Americans knew what was going on.
Yeah.
But what's funny about it at the time is that nobody cared what America was doing. Like, the Brits were, like, you know, eyeballing, you know, monarchs, you know, getting overthrown in France and the rise of an oligarchy. Oligarchy, yep. I always want to say oligopoly because of my background.
kind of like that, actually.
Yeah.
Oligopoly?
Oligopoly, yeah. That'd be a fun board game.
Right.
So if you and your friends get together and twice fix.
Yeah. You play with your little brother and he's the only one who has to pay anything.
Yeah, right. Very, very economically inefficient, but better than Monopoly. Right. Yeah, I'm enjoying this slightly better than Monopoly, but still not well. so they get together. So they, you know, we're trading with the Spaniards, we're signing treaties with them. I mean, think of it. If it was really controlled by the French, the Spanish would not be able to restrict flow on the Mississippi River. Like, we had to know. Like, come on. So, the treaty goes back. But the Spaniards say, "Hey, Napoleon, we want to get back on air. But as you're, you know, doing this expansion in Italy and you're getting all this new power, the French, in exchange for Louisiana, the French promised to establish a Spanish Bourbon prince on the throne of Tuscany as compensation for the loss of Louisiana." So I just love the idea that, like...
So France traded Italy to Spain so that way they could sell Louisiana to us.
Like, kind of? actually? But I do think that... So this was in 1801, so, like, I'm talking, like 8 months after the deal's done, the Duchy of Parma, which, you know, it was ruled by this guy, Ferdinand I of Bourbon, and he was reconfigured to be the king of... You know, essentially that entire area, obviously heavily influenced by Mr. Napoleon.
Right.
Because it's important to remember at this time in Italy, there's no real Italian state. You didn't see that until Victor Emmanuel II in like the late 1860s. This is mostly like papal states. You know, there's some independent movements like with Sardinia and Piedmont and stuff like that. But
this is during that time when it was kind of just still Holy Roman Empire, kind of clinging onto the vestiges of that empire.
Yeah. I mean, yes. The Holy Roman Empire probably, yeah. I mean, it's a leftover remnant of the Holy.
You leftover know, the papal remnant, states, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, papal states are just a very interesting topic because I mean they were on the map before Germany was. Like, mm-hmm. Germany didn't get unified until like the late 1840s. So yes,
yeah. One of their biggest leaders was actually a Roman emperor, King Frederick.
But yeah, Spain was a dying country at this point, so they were happy to give it over to the French, not have to pay to enforce anymore, and the French needed money. Like, at the end of the day, the French are fighting, they hadn't really started the war with Germany. Oh, sorry, Germany. That applies most times throughout history, so I don't feel too bad.
I know.
That's fun. with the Brits. Anyways, they needed money, so Thomas Jefferson sends over a few diplomats to negotiate, and Jefferson's like, hey. And this is where Jefferson, again, the hypocrisy of Jefferson, because he did not believe, he was a strict constitutionalist, and he didn't really believe in doing this. Like, he didn't believe that, you know, presidents really should be able to buy, or however you want to say, should have the ability to expand borders. Right. But, you know, it got voted on by Congress. I don't want to make this out that he was, like, this pure hypocrite. No, he was like, hey, I want to buy this, but it still got voted on by Congress, and it passed, like, 21-7. I think that was what it passed at. He said, offer them $10 million. He had no idea they were going to say yes. He was like, this is a crazy idea. And they were like, they huddled up. I have to think they actually huddled up. Like,
I bet you they did.
Let's see if we can get 15 from these guys. All right. Like, okay. So they came back, they were like 15. And then even the diplomat was like, oh, sure. He was like, you know, just like, you like text Jefferson, like, yo,
hold on. Let me check with my boss. I have to see if I can. I don't think I'm authorized to go this high.
Yeah, and so it was really funny. So, yeah, it was $15 million, which is about $10 billion in today's money, which feels like a steal. I mean, that feels
still
like
does.
Other
things that we purchased for $15 million, roughly, I think Alaska was, like, right around that range, right? And then also the Gadsden Purchase, I think, was about $15
million. Oh, I feel like the Gadsden Purchase was so tiny amount of land.
Yeah, it was. You know, that was also supposed to contain a port until they bribed the surveyor to just take that little turn up north.
Remember how we were talking about how important surveyors were in early American history? Yeah, yeah. All right, there we go. Apparently, God, look at you. You had one in the holster.
I might have actually brought that up last week, so I don't know. might be going back to the holster.
So about $10 billion in today's money. Now, obviously, I just want to put a quick caveat. I hate when people are like, something in 1803 in today's dollars is this amount. No, there's no way we're able to calculate it. We have broad inflationary numbers that would put it roughly at that number. It's about 3.9% inflation, something like that over time. But no, it's really, you can't measure stuff that far away. Like the value of purchasing a dollar is doesn't work. Like,
too far,
But for layman's terms, you could definitely say, like, if you said $10 billion, nobody can challenge you on that. Like, you're like, well, actually, my model shows it's different. Like, just take inflation and try it and go that way.
I think the craziest thing is this is still, that's a sum that a normal person could have had laying around.
Yeah, it's a quarter Twitter.
Like a person could have went out and bought that.
Yeah.
It's
like,
What's wild to me. Yeah. Imagine if, like, suppose somebody else just went and purchased it. Maybe Abigail sitting there cashed in some of her muni bonds and thought, you know what?
So I fell down the rabbit hole when I was researching this earlier this week, which happens literally all the time with everything I research. I'm the worst researcher in the world. That's why I like economics and mathematics, is eventually you get to the end of a formula. You never get to the end of anything with history. Like, that's what makes it so entertaining. It's always a better story. So they never marketed it. Nobody even knew it was for sale. But in practicality, they couldn't sell it to anybody else. But my favorite part about this is that it's like 3 years after they told Spain would have the first right of refusal. And Napoleon's like, nah.
Never mind.
And it's not like Spain wasn't there. That was the only two. There was three countries. There was three European nations that were active in that area. And it was America, which, again, eventually became its own country. Then you had the Brits, and then you had the Spanish. So it was like he could have walked over to the guy who said he would buy it. But Napoleon was like, nah, the country's already falling apart and it's too poor, so I'm not even going to call them up. Jerk. It's part of the treaty. You have to. They got, like, sued in court. If you have the first right of refusal on a property, you can't. The other guy sells it. You don't get to, like, shrug your shoulders.
Right.
But I wonder, like, what was Spain going to do? Go fight them?
I know. Was Spain really going to go and enforce that?
Yeah. Now, some important context here is that France just got, had just been thrown out of Haiti a few years before this. And Haiti was just this incredibly wealthy, just super wealthy nation, colony, I don't know what you want to call it, because it was so unique in itself. Mm-hmm. Not, it wasn't making the Haitian people wealthy, don't get me wrong, but it was producing a ton of sugarcane for France. It just made so much money. So then France gets it. So the same year it gets sold, 1803, that's when England and the Brits start going to war. One of my favorite parts about this is that the how the deal was financed was that the $15 million was broken up between two portions. One, the pretty much we had already had like kind of the endish of the quasi wars,
mm-hmm.
give or take. I mean, they were effectively over. So the French owed the Brit owed the U.S. a ton of money from all the pirates' activity. this is gonna get wild. That's what it was. See, this is, and again, we don't cover this in history classes, and that's like I will say throughout this entire series, that's not an indictment on history teachers. It's like what I said earlier: you fall down the rabbit hole, you can only go so deep. The poor history teachers have to get to the end somewhere. Kyle and I don't have that burden.
It's a shame though, because you scrub all the flavor out of it when you do that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So
show it up to like what is arguably the greatest military power on the planet. Be like, hey, not only do we lowball you on this offer, but also now I'm going to start. Now you're going to start paying for all the stuff you broke.
So. Oh, and it was not a little amount of money. Up to $15 million? 3.75. We were just like, you need to take that off the top. They were just like, you got to cut that out because you owe us money from all the privateer damage. And the French were like, ah, fair enough. They're just like, yeah. So the other $11.25 million, that was not paid for in cash. It was actually it was supposed to be 15-year bonds. It ended up being like 20. The last payment we made to close out the purchase was in 1823.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and gave them we gave them $11.25 million in US bonds at about a 6% interest rate. Which seems bonkers. I don't know what interest rates were that long ago. Like, that's not something we study in economics, because the concept of, like, macroeconomics in general was under Keynes. So that's, like, the 1940s, 1930s. So we give them to the French, and the French are like, sweet, thanks. We're at war with the Brits. We need some money. They then went to British banks, and the British banks bought the bonds at about a 12.5% discount. So they walked away with, like, $9-ish million, $9.5-ish million
from the Brits to fight the Brits.
The
Brits finance their own war against themselves.
I'm a huge fan of that. It's like I
love that.
We're in 2025 right now. All right, December 31st, Ukrainians were still getting paid by Russians to pass gas through their pipelines.
Yeah.
Into Europe, because that was part of a deal. I forget when that deal was inked. It was inked, I think, in like 2020 or something like that. And they just stopped. So, like, whenever it's crazy during wars, and this is surprising, where economic you see trading, you still see trading between nations even when they're at war. And it's actually like, some people think like, oh, it's like I've read a lot of contemporary stuff right now talking about the Ukrainians doing that. In a pure game theory, pure microeconomics, that's absolutely logical. You're better off having that trade. And people will say, like, well, the other side's using that money for weapons and stuff. And it's like, yes, but you're also, you have that same ability to do that.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
so it sums out to zero, except now you just have more efficiency gains. But yeah, it's, so that was happening in the 1800s. It's happening in 2025. Or I should say it was happening until 2025. So, I mean, who's Taiwan's largest trade partner?
Right.
China. Yeah,
China?
Right? China. So France ended up selling the bonds at discount to the person it was fighting a war with, and the U.S. made the payments to Britain.
I love that they had to go to the Brits and take that huge haircut too.
Yeah, is that funny? That's awesome. And you gotta think, and think about this real quick. So like, this is kind of funny. So they had about 12.5% discount rate. See, this one's cool. So the Brits maintain amazing treasury records, like.
Mm-hmm.
There's few nations on earth like England or Britain who just maintain such good records going back so long. Use so much good cleometrical research with them. You can take modern micro and macroeconomic models and like apply them to Britain just because there's so much data to do it. That's why so many papers are written about them. On top of they produce some of the best economists of all time. So They take the, so the Brits take this haircut, but if you think about it, the discount rate, and you know, Kyle, you're a very good finance mind, the discount rate should have been less than 6%. If this new country full of a bunch of angry pilgrims is getting 6%,
yeah,
you're the most powerful navy on earth and the most powerful military, like, a little more secure, right? It's like 2%? And you took 12.5%? Like, you're desperate, man. You're desperate. Yeah, yeah. That, so I always wondered what that, like, so that was.
What was Portugal or Russia offering? Like, surely somebody else out there had some cash.
Right. Right. No, exactly. Somebody had to have had money. Like, I'm sure, like, yeah, Portugal, I'm sure somebody had, like, Brazil was incredible, was starting to get, well, Brazil didn't exist yet. There was, like, the United States of, it's like Colombia, I forget what, Gran Colombia was kind of the thing that was talked about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they were, they had a ton of money. I think at this time, the Argentinians were starting to become really, you know, really economically advanced. It was weird. I mean, Argentina.
How were the Dutch doing at this time? Are they starting their decline?
Yeah, they were pretty much on the out at this point. I'm not an expert in anything, but I do love economic history, and you know, the Dutch, you know, it was hard to maintain colonies that far away from you.
Yeah.
Really, really hard to do that. That is, it was impressive they were able to do it as long as they could. But so they make this trade, it goes through. My favorite part about it is the French turn to the U.S. They're like, hey, if you ever sell this land, you have to sell it back to us. And the Americans are like, did you?
No, do you remember what we?
We were neighbors with Spain. The Spanish. Like, we border Spain, which is wild to think that the U.S. bordered Spain. Like, that's a historically factual thing to say.
Right.
They're our neighbors. We never fought a war. We never fought a war with them. We're like, what are you talking about? We're like, we know you were supposed to sell like back to Spain.
Right.
Like, what are you doing, man? Like, don't yell at us.
You mentioned the very beginning that like the borders are kind of very ambiguous. So how did that end up getting resolved?
Yeah, it was probably another 30 to 40 years. Obviously, the big one's Lewis Clark expedition.
The Louisiana Territory defined then? Like, what were the boundaries on record?
Yeah, so it gets really, really vague. So they'll use different the term they used, just if you're curious, they defined it like this. They said the west of the Mississippi River to the east side of the Rockies.
To the east side of the Rockies. So basically, yeah. Not California, but all the way up through like Nevada and up through Utah, Idaho, Washington.
Yep. And it's important to remember is that we didn't have a good understanding of what the Rockies even were at this time.
Do we even know the Rockies were there?
We had like kind of an idea the Rockies existed, but no, the answer is no. Right. The answer is broadly no. Not good enough to send like 16 fearless explorers into the West. No, we thought there was still like let me tell you something funny. So as I'm going through, you know, spoiler, as we mentioned earlier, the special episode for Jefferson's going to be Lewis and Clark. And so doing my homework on Lewis and Clark, like, you know, I picked up a couple of nice books on this because nice. I just find, you know, Kyle's a big Lewis and Clark fan. So I was like, I really got to do this nice. Like, I got to do this. I want to make sure we're going to have fun with this one because we all kind of know the story of Lewis and Clark, but we don't. There's some funny stuff that happened.
They kept some pretty good journals, right?
They did. They really did. It was really impressive. They thought the Rocky Mountains were like the Appalachian Mountains.
Whoops.
Yeah, they thought this was going to be like, we'll be able to transverse this. And again,
they thought they were going to be there like in the summer, right? It took them like 4 years.
Yeah, yeah. So it was, it took them 14 to 16 months to get out there.
What I find wild too about that whole thing is they get to the Pacific coast over in Washington, and there's like just a ship waiting there for them to like take mail for them. Like, what? Really? Like
was it Fort? Again, we don't want to give away too much, but like the little fort they built. No, dude, it is really interesting. So they thought it was like the Appalachian Mountains, and again, not like history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. The first guy to attempt to climb the first European who attempted to climb Mount Everest, he prepped for climbing Mount Everest by walking the hills in England.
Oh, okay. Smart.
Yeah.
I bet that worked pretty well.
Yeah, then fly a plane to Mount Everest and try and, like, get off, and then, like...
Does he wear a green jacket?
I'm trying to remember, but he was not
green,
dressed.
Was it green well boots? Enough. What's the...
There's green boots. Green. Yeah, that's a landmark.
Yeah, yeah. Is he still there?
they moved him out of sight fairly recently.
Was that him?
No, they didn't find his body till like, a couple years ago. He's like perfectly preserved, so there's like neon orange hair. Fun fact about me, I'm absolutely obsessed with Mount Everest. I think it's crazy to want to climb it, but I'm just every story, because everything about Mount Everest is terrifying.
I just love the fact that there's something called a death zone that people voluntarily, you know, traverse.
Yeah, one of my favorite things I've ever read is that like Mount Everest is not considered a technically difficult mountain to climb.
It's just so high that you can't breathe.
Just so high you can't breathe.
Yeah.
Like Into Thin Air is one of my absolute favorite movies and books of all time. I have very heated opinions about that whole situation, despite I should never have an opinion on mountaineering. I shouldn't be allowed to have an opinion on it. Because, it's me. I don't like going outside, man. It's like snowing right now. I'm just like, nah, I'm good. I'll stay inside all day.
So I'm trying to wrap my head around what Louisiana should have been. So it's basically everything west of the Mississippi to the Appalachian Mountains. So it should have included like Texas and New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, all of those states that were, I think, part of Spain at the time. I can see why Spain didn't want to really flesh that out either, because they probably had some tough conversations to have too.
Yeah, I mean, this is the part, we talk about world history. It took a long time for the Spanish Empire to die. This was the first kind of mortal wound that they suffered. And you could argue that it didn't end until, the war, the Spanish-American War. You could argue it didn't. I mean, they were in turmoil, and then they were a fascist state, until the 70s. Just weird.
Didn't send a bunch of people over there? Like, in between World War I, World War II is when that whole battle was going on, right? The fight for fascism.
Yeah, Spanish Civil War.
I want to say Ernest Hemingway is actually there fighting, too.
Yeah, everybody sucked. That was everybody. That was just the Nazis were perfecting dive bombing during that time, too.
Right.
It
was kind of like the staging grounds for testing out, what the next war was going to look like.
Yeah, then World War II ended, and they were still fascist for 30 years.
I did not realize that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really... Spain's still Spain. They're a very weird economy.
I know there's some really cool, if you you can go drive through towns that they've built up that have nobody living in them, ginormous airports, fully built functioning towns that nothing in it.
During the Great Recession, they did something called Plan D, and they basically were like, "Here's a bunch of money. Let's just start building stuff to stimulate the economy." Which
they're going with the China approach.
Yes, but imagine that, but with less industrious...
Less money.
And less money, yes.
And less people.
Wild thing. So, Spain is one of the... has the most productive auto workers in the Eurozone. The average Spanish auto worker makes about 15 cars a year.
And what is the Spanish vehicle of choice that they're making over there?
I don't know. I think they just do parts for other major vehicles. 9 out of 10 Spanish cars manufactured in Spain leave the country. Just a random Spanish economic knowledge.
Are you going to say they fall apart or something?
No, actually pretty well. I believe they leave the world in anchovy production, too.
Anchovies? I like anchovies.
Yeah, I believe they also pioneered a lot of the aluminum canning process, which comes back to Napoleon, because he was the guy who was put out an RFP for canning.
So that's what my grandpa used to do for quite some time, was work canning for Reynolds. Reynolds actually bought his company at the time when he was working there. Yeah,
oh, that's good.
I worked for Alcoa for a couple of years, but they did mostly airplane parts at the place I worked at.
See, that's what you just gave the best example of intensified economics, where it's we went from 30 years, 40 years before we were using metal to make cans to now making aircraft parts. You could still buy canned food because we found another country to trade with that could do that more efficiently. That's why trade is good. Mm-hmm. It's weird to be living in a timeline where the follow up sentence has to be trade is good. But it is so. Spain was Spain really had no way to enforce whatever that Western bound, whatever
right.
Western bound.
Yeah, I think we found that out with Texas.
Yeah, no, right? I mean, exactly.
Yeah.
So they went out, cut across that, the Lewis and Clark expedition would cut across that entire area, but nobody really knew the economic benefit. I mean, you got to think of what this area was. It was really hard to access forests. There was some prairie grasslands, and there was a very lucrative trade down the Mississippi, but the U.S. already had the right to go down the Mississippi and trade freely. So,
yeah, but how much was that artery through the heart of the United States worth? I would venture that was probably the most beneficial part of that entire agreement.
Yeah, yeah, you are correct. So, absolutely. What ended up happening, I don't want to say what ended up happening, but what ended up being the case is that the argument was that we purely secured the most important waterway.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it was the most important waterway at that time in the U.S., but would easily become the most important waterway. Probably say like the canal systems, like the Hudson River would probably
be
the most
important waterway. But that was also what connected it to the Mississippi then. The Mississippi is what connected to the Gulf, I mean, right?
Okay. Yeah. I will, Kyle, I actually, you know what? I'm team. That's actually the right answer. so I guess it was still the most important waterway. My favorite part about reading through this is that everybody was pumped in the U.S.
Yeah.
Like everybody. it was great because, I don't know, everybody.
What about the people in Louisiana?
There was
nobody
in there.
There's somebody was there. There's some French people like wandering around collecting their pelts and find out that tomorrow they're going to be American. Like, how wild is that?
All right. So part of the sale, the parts of Louisiana Louisiana purchase.
Citizenship?
We had to give them citizenship.
Yeah.
They were allowed to keep all their property. The Treaty of Cession is actually like what has Louisiana purchase in it. So we had to give them like all citizenship. We had to respect all their properties, all that stuff. How vague it was, the treaty said we have to give them citizenship as soon as reasonable.
No. Okay. I love it when language like that is written in a contract.
I cannot wait until like some random descendant living in like the backwoods of Arkansas gets like a notice being like, actually, we're taking back citizenship. Like, oh, damn. I was like, wow, that was, government is really slow. I didn't think it was that slow. Right. So the only people against it were the Federalists. Like,
the people who didn't. Were they against it for the reason that they just didn't believe the federal government should be owning property?
Bingo. That's literally, they were. Yeah. And I don't think they were against it. I think they were against Jefferson. They were like, yeah, screw this guy. Like, yeah. I think that was the attitude. Their main points were they questioned the constitutionality of the acquisition and saying basically the government lacked explicit authority to purchase new territories. Yeah, and then some of the Federalists, they were like, oh, these new lands are going to dilute the political power of eastern states. And obviously, the western states are already very pro-Jefferson. Now Jefferson just doubled, essentially, more than doubled the size of the United States. So they thought that was going to be like more voting power for him. Though, you know how long it takes states. I mean, some of these, think of it, Kansas-Nebraska Acts, they came 1840s, 1850s. And then the purchase price of $15 million. They were like, oh, that's going to increase the national debt. That's going to be horrible. like fast forward today, like $10 billion. It's like not even a couple minutes of operation. Now, there was one group that was opposed to it, but they were not opposed to the purchase of the land. It's very, I want to make this back because a lot of times this gets conflated as in like they were anti-Louisiana purchase, but the abolition movement was concerned because they knew these are eventually going to become states. And we never decided how we were going to adjudicate by this point.
Were they going to be slave states or are they going to be free states?
Yeah.
This was before the parallel line was that agreement?
Yeah.
It's like the
Missouri
the 51st parallel or whatever that is that they're.
Yes. Yeah, so
that one. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you.
Yeah. The Missouri Compromise, which is also why Massachusetts no longer has Maine. So I feel bad for my Mainers that they are no longer part of the best state in America.
Wait, Massachusetts used to own Maine?
Yeah, we did. Until the Compromise of 1820. Okay. The Missouri Compromise. Because they were like, yo, Missouri, coming as a slave state, we need to find another state to give two senders to. And somebody's like, what about Maine? And Maine's like, said nothing because nobody lives there. And then now you have Maine as a state. Can't wait till we get a bunch of Maine hate mail. And it'd be mail because I don't know if they've earned that access. I mean, me to Maine. I love Maine. Go to Maine all the time. It's a great state. It's like actually a great state. It's yeah. I do very much like Maine. I just feel like as somebody from Massachusetts, I feel like I have to be like, yes, it's, you know, it's scorned because they're no longer part of us. Makes me sad. It's like all the Massachusetts.
I still can't wrap my head around the fact that pilgrims probably sounded like you.
Yeah, is that horrible? Is that like the story you've read?
That's all I can hear now is just just Peter Griffin signing the Declaration of Independence. Oh, this is wicked awesome.
No, the funnier part is that this is probably what King George sounded like.
What?
Yeah, because we sounded like the British.
But that's even wilder.
Yeah, then that's when like Cockney accent came because like we don't want to sound like the colonials, and yeah, so I think it's like King George getting like the Declaration of Independence. He's like, well, I won't swear because I don't want to get bleeped out. But like, hey, it's hard not to do the Boston accent without swearing. But he's just probably like, what's this? What? No, these God, I can't do it without swearing. I actually need a swear to be able to do it. So I'll be on the Patreon. It'll be Eric reading the Declaration of Independence in a heavy Boston accent. But yeah, just imagine like average Red Sox or Bruins fan. King George.
Pats fan. anything else you want to say on this before we close up shop here?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just kind of ending on this, part of the Louisiana Purchase, it definitely was Jefferson's longest lasting agency, I don't want to use the word agency, but the longest lasting effect that he had was the Louisiana Purchase. At the end of the day, nobody remembers the Embargo Act. You know, as much as Jefferson wants to take credit for the U.S. Navy, that wasn't him, that was Adams. Nope. In fact, we're going to talk about under Madison some of the problems that Jefferson did, and he was remorseful because he defunded the Navy, and then we fought a naval war against a naval superpower. Literally, the only way to get to America to fight us at the time was the Navy. It was through sea power, and yeah. He was like, "Let's defund this. This will make
Let's
sense.
Let's defund this after we just pissed everybody off by closing our borders."
Yes,
brilliant.
but one of the cool lasting legacies from an economic standpoint of Louisiana is not just their $6 trillion in, you know, GDP. It's what it gave us for agricultural security. It's what gave us energy. A lot of energy security was generated from it. Don't forget, Wyoming produces 3 times as much coal as Appalachia does, mm-hmm. which is not just burnt anymore. Now it's used for steel production. You know, we're finding rare earth metals there. 107 million people live in the territory that now makes up Louisiana Purchase. You know, it really is the heartbeat of America, and for many, many reasons. We still see the Mississippi River still exports more agricultural products than virtually any one geographic entity in the world. It's just so important, that area of the country. I mean, if you're somebody like me who's a, you know, an East Coaster, sometimes, you know, wrongfully we refer to that area as flyover states. They're not flyover states. They are the breadbasket and the backbone of a lot of American activity. You know, you may have, you know, financial sectors on the coast, but at the end of the day, you can't trade options if you can't eat. and kind of leaving on this last note with Jefferson is, Jefferson's a complicated man, very, very complicated man. You know, he didn't know if he was right about making the Louisiana Purchase, and he actually took being reelected in 1804 as a sign that it was okay to do. And he said that because of the people who voted him in. I think as we close the book on Jefferson, and I know, you know, Jefferson has had a troubled life. But sometimes if we separate the man from their accomplishment, which we, you know, we shouldn't do that for everything, but maybe if we just for a moment just accept that premise of the separation of the two. Jefferson was a man who, while he didn't practice it, pushed for the idea, the inalienable rights of liberty. And though he did not practice what he preached, he was a man who was heavily involved in the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, which ended the slave trade in 1808. And I think if there's one redeeming character of Thomas Jefferson's life, right? If there's one day of his political life, let's not talk about his personal life. He was in office in 1808, which is when the Constitution dictated the slave trade had to end.
Mm-hmm.
And he heavily enforced it. So if there's one thing that we can say, who is this complicated man? I don't know if that makes him more complicated or less complicated, but I think it was just interesting to see that he, at the end of his political career, in his old age, especially for that time, one of the last things he did when he had power was to enforce the Constitution in the slave trade.
Yeah, it's easy to do that when you've already made all of your benefits from it.
Yep. Very much agreed.
Yeah.
And one closing note on it, I know Kyle and I have made a point to thank Monticello.
Yes.
And that organization, the just the Jefferson Foundation. I mean, God love them. God love those historians. They, and those stewards of American history. This is all on their website. Everything from what we talked about, from James Hemming to Sally Hemings to his, you know, even the really stuff that's more, you know, I would say unsettling about Jefferson's life. They record it. They devote entire pages. They devote entire multimedia exercises to talk about James Hemming and Sally Hemings. They should really be lifted up in this. Those people do an amazing job. Absolutely an amazing job.
Yeah, they cannot accuse them of trying to brush over anything over there. No, they shine the spotlight on everything.
Everything.
All right, but I think that's probably where we're going to have to put a pin in this, as otherwise we'll just keep going for another probably 3 hours. So join us next week. We plan to fully explore the Lewis and Clark expedition, since it's probably the topic least likely to get this new show canceled. In the meantime, though, we do want to hear from you. Do you think Jefferson was playing 4D chess while his contemporaries ate crowns, or was he just a big old hypocrite? Email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com, or you can visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com. You can sub on your favorite platforms to stay up to date with the show, and we'll see you all next week.